Following are some comments on William Shakespeare's Pericles, Prince of Tyre, Act II, including Gower's chorus. Fortune, tired with doing bad, threw him ashore to give him glad. John Gower relates how Pericles survived a shipwreck off the coast of Pentapolis while on his way home to Tyre. In Chorus 2, John Gower promises a fully fledged morality tale, with Pericles sure to gain from the series of adversities he is about to undergo. On comes the shipwreck, and Pericles drifts until, says Gower, quote unquote, fortune, tired with doing bad, threw him ashore to give him glad. Act 2, Chorus, lines 37 through 38. Indeed, this should remind us that Pericles' misfortunes throughout the play are not brought on by error or flaw. They're due to bad luck or chance or perhaps providence. The play is not suffused with the sensibility or ambience of classical tragedy. Pericles has done nothing wrong, has not made a mistake. What in the Poetics Aristotle calls hamartia, error, mistake, missing of the mark, is not in play in Pericles, Prince of Tyre. The protagonist has simply run up against the chaotic powers of elemental humanity, namely Antiochus, and the natural world, meaning the rough ocean with its pulverizing storms. I, as fits my nature, do obey you. Pericles washes up along the coast of Pentapolis, and some humble fishermen tell him there's a tournament scheduled in honor of the king's daughter, Thaisa. In Act 2, Scene 1, Pericles faces trouble by sea. It won't be his last trial by water. Shipwrecks are metaphoric of the travails of life in the time between the ultimate passage from birth to death. As such, they show humanity tossed back and forth at, quote-unquote, the conflux of two eternities, to borrow a line from Thomas Carlyle in his historical study, The French Revolution. The sea and its storms are an alien realm that threatens to cast all that's dear to humanity into the void. Until modern times, any kind of prolonged travel was apt to be treacherous and uncertain, with sea voyages inspiring the greatest fear of all. In Homer's Odyssey, the narrator describes the coming on of night with the wonderful line, "The sun went down and all the world's paths turned dark." Even on land, the dark levels humanity with raw nature. Nighttime is for the animals. Humans have no special purchase there. Here in an Elizabethan-Jacobean play, the ocean takes on something like this leveling power, which entails a sense of profound uncertainty and violence. The sea is a roadway for the realization of desire, but it is also a place of peril, a resetting track for past woes and felicities. It's the great equalizer in the play, in that even princes are subject to its vicissitudes. Pericles humbly wishes for little but a dry death after his ordeal at sea, saying to the elements, quote unquote, "I, as fits my nature, do obey you." Act 2, Scene 1, Line 4. But soon he's in the company of some humble, good-natured fishermen, as they air their views on relations between the realm's social classes, the sum of the general opinion being that, like the fishes, quote-unquote, the great ones eat up the little ones. Act 2, Scene 1, lines 28 through 29. Pericles makes himself known to these rustics and adopts a key of begging suitable to his plight. He is received kindly, and the fishermen inform him of an upcoming tournament, whereby a skillful and fortunate knight-at-arms will get a chance to impress Thaisa, daughter of the virtuous King Simonides, whose, quote-unquote, peaceable reign and good government the first fisherman praises. Act 2, Scene 1, Line 100. When a rusty suit of armor is spied in the nets, Pericles hails its appearance, since he informs the fisherman, "It was given to him by his father, and it is such a precious artifact to him that it all but banishes the shipwreck and other losses from his mind. The fishermen gladly turn the armor over to Pericles and even agree to make him a garment to wear underneath it. They hope to be gainers along with him should he win, but their deed is generous in any case. In expe vivo, in this hope I live. The joust for Thaisa's favor gets underway, and the seemingly ramshackle knight Pericles wins. In Act 2, Scene 2, Simonides and his daughter Thaisa are introduced to us, while Pericles is introduced as the last of a series of knights seeking the favor of Thaisa. What we begin to see is an appropriate courtly spectacle, and what seems to be a healthy relationship between a father and his daughter. This is not a court dominated by secrecy and intrigue. Whatever dark Freudian jealousy may lie within King Simonides is kept firmly where it belongs, beneath the level of consciousness. Each seeker marches forth on his horse to display his emblem in hopes of success. The king and his daughter will judge the contest partly on the basis of each man's ingenuity. The first knight, a Spartan, presents as his Latin motto, quote unquote, "Your light is life to me." The second knight is a Macedonian prince, and his motto translated from the Italian is, quote unquote, "More by sweetness than by force." The third knight comes from Antioch, and his device is, quote unquote, "The summit of glory has led me on." Then comes a knight from Athens, whose device is, quote unquote, "Who nourishes me, extinguishes me." The fifth knight hails from Corinth, and his motto is, quote unquote, "Thus is faith to be regarded." Pericles is the final contestant, and his appearance is hardly promising, what with his rusty suit of armor and lack of assistance in proffering his device. All he has is, quote unquote, "a withered branch that's only green at top," and his motto is, quote unquote, "In hac spe vivo," or in English, "In this hope I live." Act 2, Scene 2, Line 43. There is nothing inappropriate about the display and motto of the first five gentlemen, but Pericles is the only one among them whose situation really matches his motto and self-presentation. The only thing he has going for him is hope. He lacks resources at present and is dependent for his future upon the outcome of the contest. With regard to the other five men, the mottos they present are standard and conventional. None of these men are impoverished and desperate, but rather each is wealthy and privileged. The stakes are not the same for them as they are for Pericles. There is, in Pericles' case, that is, a perfect adequation between symbol and reality, between situation and display. King Simonides picks up on this fact and gently rebukes the three fashionable lords with whom he is holding converse, saying, quote unquote, "Opinion's but a fool that makes us scan the outward habit for the inward man." Act 2, Scene 2, Lines 54 through 55. They were looking for a precise match between the knight's attire and his personal worth, but the king sees the more important match that lies beyond such facile observation. Pericles goes on to win the contest, thus ending the scene. "I see that time's the king of men." Pericles enjoys his turn of fortune when King Simonides hosts a banquet and a dance, partly in his honor as champion of the joust. In Act 2, Scene 3, Simonides and Thaisa together constitute a guest-host antidote to Antiochus and his ruined daughter. Leaving Freudian readings aside for the time being, we see that everything they do is gracious and decorous, rather than garish, narcissistic, or lewd. The knights are equally gracious in their regard for the lowly Pericles. Pericles himself shows a great deal of humility in this scene, and a certain amount of melancholy as well. It's as if he can't help being a bit overshadowed by his previous experience with a kingly father and daughter back in Antioch. In beholding Simonides, he is prompted to thoughts of his own departed father, whom he describes in terms almost reminiscent of Hamlet's high praise of his father. What kind of protagonist succeeds in a romance of any sort? We might expect that the protagonist would need a combination of energy, boldness, and openness to experience, the latter being an ancient value found in heroes such as Odysseus. There are times when something like this might be true, but Pericles, who has already shown himself capable of audacity, as when he pursued the daughter of Antiochus, shows a Christian-like degree of humility and patience. Quote unquote, "I see that time's the king of men. He's both their parent and he is their grave, and gives them what he will, not what they crave." Act 2, Scene 3, lines 44 through 46. In Shakespeare's romance plays, this quality of admitting one's limitations seems to be as important as any other quality we could name. Both Simonides and Thaisa show themselves to be honest characters, but the conversation between them reveals a certain complexity in their decorous relationship. As the asides indicate, the main characters in this scene are capable of keeping their own counsel, even as they engage in fitting conversation with others. Simonides seems to be already trying to temper what he must suppose is the passion beginning to stir in Thaisa for Pericles, while Thaisa herself shows a maiden's regard for her chaste reputation. When the king tells Thaisa to bring Pericles a bowl of wine, she responds hesitantly, quote unquote, "It befits not me unto a stranger knight to be so bold." Act 2, Scene 3, lines 64 through 65. Yet, to herself, she admits that she is very pleased with Pericles. These asides are by no means dishonest. They are instead signs of a need to shape appropriate social and romantic outcomes, and to avoid some of the pitfalls of courtship. This is part of the work of society, of civilization itself. Honesty does not always require full disclosure of one's entire intent. Characters who show themselves to be too sparse or too blunt with their words often run into trouble, even though their moral character may be spotless and their intentions good. As examples, consider Cordelia and Kent, respectively, in King Lear. Having been asked in classical fashion his birth and purpose here in Pentapolis, Pericles casts himself as a knight-errant, a man, quote-unquote, looking for adventures in the world, even though that description doesn't fit his present circumstances well. Act 2, Scene 3, line 80. It wasn't pure wanderlust that drove him from Tyre to Tarsus and thence to Pentapolis. He was fleeing a political enemy, bringing aid to Tarsus, and then, as he admits to the king, barely surviving a disaster at sea. The king significantly offers gifts and personal friendship to Pericles, then orders up a dance for the still-armored knights. He teases Pericles and Thaisa into pairing off on the dance floor, thereby continuing the pursuit of Thaisa that the now-completed joust began. At last, the dancing is done and the hour is late, so it's time for everyone to take their rest. When peers thus knit, a kingdom ever stands. News comes of the shocking demise of Antiochus and his daughter, and Helicanus convinces Tyre's anxious lords to search abroad for Pericles. In Act 2, Scene 4, the scandal of Antiochus and his daughter is illuminated in a terrible way, at least for those in the know already. That is, it's brought to light by a bolt of lightning that strikes their carriage one day out of the blue. "The foul stench of the bodies," says Helicanus, "so offended the common people that no one would give the two burial." There are usually Machiavellian concerns in any Shakespeare play with a political dimension. The lords in Pericles' realm are beginning to worry that the prince came to a bad end in his ocean-going travels, hardly an unreasonable supposition. The lords know that power hates a vacuum, and an absent prince is bad for them and the whole realm. conducive as such absence is to instability and the threat of foreign invasion. Helicanus is able to put them off for 12 months, but he understands that their patience is not infinite. It's all he can do to prevent them from anointing him ruler, which he swore to Pericles he would never allow to happen. But in the end, the lords agreed to go in search of their absent leader. The voyage should keep their energies occupied for a time. Helicanus and the lords clasp hands, and he tells them approvingly, quote unquote, "When peers thus knit, a kingdom ever stands." Act 2, Scene 4, Line 59. My actions are as noble as my thoughts. Pericles deals forthrightly with Simonides's feigned disapproval of his love for Thaisa, and the match is made. In Act 2, Scene 5, King Simonides briefly dissembles his intention to allow the match between his daughter Thaisa and Pericles, putting on a stormy show for them and even threatening the life of Pericles. But with comical celerity, he ends up revealing his true intentions that they should soon be wed. We can connect this scene with Prospero's gruffness in The Tempest towards young Prince Ferdinand of Naples, when he takes an interest in the Duke's daughter, Miranda. For that matter, there was the menace by Aegeus in A Midsummer Night's Dream against his daughter, Hermia, which Duke Theseus of Athens at first supported and then disregarded. There's probably some real paternal jealousy involved in the behavior of both Simonides and Prospero. But in truth, both men are trying to ensure that their daughters don't wind up married to an unworthy suitor. There seems to be some idea that, as Lysander says in Midsummer, true love never runs quite smoothly. Some obstacle, even if it be a contrived one, seems necessary, or at least inevitable. In the course of this manufactured trial, Pericles shows courage over and above his alarm, while Thaisa stands up admirably against Simonides. Thanks for listening. The date of this audio recording is Monday, June 9th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.